Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the program. I'm glad you stopped by KNSS every Saturday, noon to 1. It's Good Life Guy and Food, Wine, and Fun for Your Ears. I've done so many programs where I could say I wish you were here. This, of course, is certainly one of them. We've been having a wonderful time in Sonoma in the spring. Bud break happening down in Calistoga and gradually working north. I think by the time we leave, it'll start being really green down south. We're at Jordan Winery. You know it. You've seen it on wine lists at your favorite restaurant. And hopefully you've used some of your wine budget to enhance your life with some of Jordan's products. And it's attributable not only to an entire team of people, but to one guy in particular. And Rob Davis is nice enough to join us today, the longtime and forever winemaker here at Jordan. Rob, welcome to The Good Life.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Guy. Especially tasting these wines.
Yeah, and we'll talk about those, but I told you, this is your life. And we were just trying to think. Joel Aiken, for the longest time, held a position of being kind of the longest winemaker at a specific property. And there was a couple others, but I think you've passed everybody now. Let's see, are we 39 years?
42.
How many?
42. I started here in 76, so this will be coming up. Yeah.
Yeah, see, that makes me feel old. Thanks.
You know, and I worked with Joel. We did it actually a barrel experiment when he came out of UC Davis. So, yeah, I was a little ahead of him, too.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the beginning. I think everyone who has ever enjoyed wine and has the opportunity to talk to someone or hear a winemaker talk about their career, one, there is no formula. There's lawyers and doctors and farmers and pilots and, oh my God, everything. When did Rob Davis get interested in wine, and what brought you into the business long ago?
Well, I grew up in Sacramento, and I think since I was 1 year old, my folks always figured I'd be a doctor. And UC Davis had a really good pre-med program, and it wasn't going to Davis just because it was a 30-minute drive from my folks' house. It was just a really, really great competitive, great for sciences, and I love sciences. It was my roommate picked out, mainly because he loved sports, but I should tell you that when I was sitting next to the admissions officer at UC Davis on a bus going to my folks' house one Saturday, and she saw my little UC Davis emblem on my shirt. She goes, "Oh, so you're a freshman?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." She goes, "Well, you better study hard because only one of four ever go on. They just don't have the room." So I thought, boy, I better study hard. Well, I come back after studying for a calculus test, and I see my roommate sitting up by his bedstand, swirling a glass of wine, smelling it, and putting it back down. And I said, "Roomie, you can't be drinking wine while you're studying." He goes, "What are you talking about? This is what I'm studying to be, a winemaker." I had no idea that UC Davis was a school. So I started taking the classes. I got some scholarships through the program and just absolutely fell in love with the students and professors. And once I got to my junior year, I said, "You know, Mom and Dad, this is what I want to do." And my dad, I think, had the best advice for me. He says, "Whatever you do, son, make sure it's your hobby." And this is probably the best hobby I've ever had in my life.
Such an interesting time. When you think back, you know, 40 plus years ago, 50 years ago, our winemaking business compared to our friends in France is infantile. And so you can take credit not only for working with some of the real, no kidding, founders of our wine business, but for being a big part of that. Tell us how you migrated from Davis into the business and where you worked and your relationship with Andrei Chelichov, the master doctor of wine.
I graduated in 1976, and I started the first harvest at Jordan just by luck. They were just building they're putting on the roof when I was doing the interview. And later on, when they hired me and I started working with Andre, I mean, you talk about two people born into a sandbox together. He was 55 years my senior, yet energy-wise, I could not keep up with him. He was just brilliant in ways of never holding to a certain plan. He was always wanting to learn more. But here was a guy that it was perfect for me because my education and his particular experience in California. He came over in 1938 to Beaulieu and made wine there to 72 and then consulting after that. But he was trained in California and observing, you know, their production techniques. But more important to me is he was experienced in Europe, not just France, but throughout Europe, but particularly for France, because the Jordans were such Francophiles. And they embarked upon their journey of making wine to emulate French wines, not California wines. And I think you could not have had a better partnership with the Jordan family and Andre Chelichev, and then my empty brain that was pretty much wet clay to be able to be molded by then. But it was my experience with Andre, 18 years of traveling throughout Europe with him and learning what he described as the empirical wisdom of winemaking, that I think that definitely held reign over our winemaking in California just based on technology. But great. Those magical years for me.
Yeah. And look at technology. Now, I think we had good technology from the beginning compared to some of our old world producers. And look what's happened today. The use of technology, you know, keeping track of tanks used to be a grease board or a clipboard with paper. And now you can sit in your office and look at every tank and things that are going on in the winery. It's got to be an interesting revolution that, and I would hope, in a ways, makes your job a lot easier.
Oh, absolutely. It keeps evolving. And I think, when I started at Jordan 76, you know, really the benchmark for all wines globally was Bordeaux, Burgundy, you know, of course, sparkling wine was Champagne, but it was all, really was France. It was not not Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Italy, Germany. Anyway, it was all France. And of course, there was only 300 wineries in all of California at that time. Now there's over 5,000. But the technology itself really was born through UC Davis. In fact, when I was at the University of Bordeaux, a lot of my peer students there said, gosh, you're lucky to go to Davis, because they felt it was a better school. And I thought having both was really important to me, because there were things I learned in the art craft that wasn't taught to me at Davis. But, you know, the technology, you're right, has evolved so much. But I remember I was on a panel with Jean Delmas from Obrion, and somebody asked him about California winemaking. And he said, California winemaking is astronomy compared to French winemaking was astrology. And I thought about that. It was a great quote, because we understood the technology in a lot of ways much better than what was going on in France. But then I think what singularly separated us from what I learned at UC Davis, from what I learned at Bordeaux, was the importance of soil, importance of what we call terroir, the combination of soil and climate and how those work together with a specific cultivar. And that, I think, is where you get the real quality elements of anywhere in the whole world where you're growing. You match the right terroir with that cultivar and provide the right husbandry for it, you can compete with any great wines of the world. That's singularly what I learned. If there was one thing, I mean, I learned millions of things from Andre, but one thing particularly I learned from Andre was always seek the right soil and climate for your fruit. And we weren't doing it at that time. Back in 76, for an appellation that should be known and is now known for Cabernet and Bordeaux varietals, 80% of wine was white wine. It was market-driven. So you had a cool climate, like a variety like Muscat Canelli, Gewürztraminer, that Alsatian varieties that require very cool climate. And we're growing it in very warm climate, but it was all market-driven. And that was what was unique about Jordan. We recognized Alexander Valley as an appellation that was best for red grapes varietals, and that's what I think now is caught up, and that's what everybody's doing
everywhere. I mean, Washington State benefited by the mistakes that we made in California. Other growing regions are benefiting by some of the successes and less than successful things that have happened in Washington State. And I think everybody realizes that what and where you plant is the key to starting out well. In the beginning, Tom Jordan wanted to make this an estate production. Everything was all grown right here on this beautiful chunk of land. And I know there were some issues, and several years ago, you and I drove around on a misty day, and you showed us some of the vineyards that you brought into the family now that it's expanded from outside the estate. Talk a little bit about why the estate stuff wasn't working out, and then some of the vineyards that you have access to now.
Tom Jordan, his major success in his life is with his oil explorations, you know, a real true wildcatter. And so he's trained in geology, certainly working with the earth sciences. But he looked at what separates the Premier of Grand Cruz, you know, Obrion, Mouton, Lafitte, Latour, even Cheval Blanc and Petrus. In fact, if you get a good fortune to go visit Petrus, and I was just, it, you know, all of us have gone to tours through wineries, but there's that singular moment when as a guest, you're informed of something that is you'll never forget. And so we got the Petrus, and so many of us as winemakers, enologists, are looking, well, so what separates this quality, a Petrus that goes for $2,500 a bottle compared to, you know, a $50, $100 bottle of wine that even Napa's making? And she took me out to the vineyard, and she dug her hand in the soil, and she goes, this is all you need to know about Petrus. Estate, just state grown. So what I recognized then was she was holding in her hand, almost like the Bible, you know, it was this beautiful, beautiful soil that was so different at Petrus than anywhere else. But Tom Jordan, I think he looked at that as that ownership control is the most important thing. What we used to call as grape growing, now we call as wine growing. And you're growing the wine in your vineyard. And he thought that if you have absolute control of that, which is really true, if you make the decisions, you know, on the snap, which is so important working with Mother Nature, your chance of success is much better. So he felt that I got the climate, I got the great cultivar, and I've got great farmer, great viticulturist that we had. And what I think was missing was the particular soil that we had, the soil that our state had more of a more closer to the Entre de Mer, to use a French comparison, but it was more deeper, loamy soils that tend to be high vigor. And when my studies with Andre traveling around, what you want is really well-drained soils. And you can have like the calcare, the limestone they talk about in Burgundy. I mean, just when you're at the bench of on the bottom of Saint-Emilion, then you take the walk up that little road there, you leave a very simple toward a more river-based soil type that's prone to giving you like a $10 to $15 bottle of wine. As you go up, you see the limestone, the soils change, and next you know, you're looking at a $500 to $1,200 bottle of wine. I mean, all within the same appellation, so to speak. But the soil was so important, and I think Tom, you know, at that time, that wasn't considered a priority for choosing your vineyard. You just chose climate and to match the cultivar and get somebody, a good farmer. And like I said, even back then, all these varieties that were being grown in an appellation that wasn't appropriate to it, nobody even thought about that. He says, you know, all I need to do is sell my fruit, as much money as I can, and Mr. Sun will always make it easy for me. And I remember all my friends when I visited France, they were saying, Mr. Sun is really, you have too much of it. And I think that's because some of those varieties just weren't appropriate that. And I think when John Jordan, when he came on in 2005, and I'm sure his father was coaching him, okay, Rob's going to tell you this, you know, and he can be very argumentative, you know, and he has, and literally from day one, from Tom and I have always been at odds, you know, we got along just great, except when it came to the propriety, you know, the priority of the soil. And he goes, oh, Rob, he says, look, you know, we just, all you need is to get maturity. Well, maturity was, the index was grapes, and it wasn't mouthfeel, it was intensity of fruit. And, you know, there wasn't much to compare with until I started looking in and getting other fruit, and I started showing it to John. And I said, John, I want you to smell this, and then I want you to smell this. And he could easily see the distinction between the two. And he said, I don't care about authorship. I don't care about estate. I just want to make great wines to compete with the world. If I had springs in my butt, I would have shot up and hit the moon. I just came out of my chair and I went, this is what I want to do. I mean, it was like giving me two extra wings to fly. And I started, from then on, I started searching for fruit. And, I mean, the wines we see here were 100% Russian River, 100% growers, because all those the growers I've selected have matched close to, as close I get to the soil structures that work so well in Burgundy. And there is some differences. We don't have limestone, but we do have gravel. And like Obrion has gravel, and you can taste some of that, the intensity of fruit that comes from that nice. It's not a high-vigor soil. It keeps the vigor down, so you get more intensity of fruit, I think. And then same thing with the Cabernet and the Merlot, and then we added Petit Verdot later on because we finally found a cleaned-up rootstock or a cleaned-up vine. As far as I know, Petit Verdot up till 1998, I think, it had a virus that you planted it, 8 years later you're pulling it out, and they finally cleaned it up, and that's turned out to be a nice addition to our blend. But overall, it's literally employing really the wisdom of the technology that I've learned at Davis, but also certainly employing the empirical wisdom of thousands of years of work that France has done in particular. And then, and same thing in Italy. The Super Tuscans are born exactly on that reason that they discovered soils that were more appropriate for Cabernet than Sangiovese. And now you have these delicious, incredible Tignanellos, Solaias, just some great, great wines. And I think that's what I think the fun of this from a consumer point of view. It's not great wines are not just relegated to just one particular area. It's relegated to now you can go. There's friends of mine in Washington. They're just producing brilliant wines, brilliant Cabernets. There's a Pinot Noir that I think in Oregon competes very well with some of the great Pinot Noirs in Burgundy. I've been to Tasmania. I had one of the best Pinot Noirs I had in my life. Where in the hell? I mean, you're so close to the Arctic Circle that you're going, whoa, I say Antarctica, but you go to these little areas and you find, wow, this one in New Zealand just blew me away. And I think we're all learning not to be subsistent on our own particular, well, this is our front yard, so this is what we're going to use. Maybe the front yard across our neighbor has a better chance. And that's, I think, what's happening today.
And we're lucky. I tell folks that I talk to all the time about wine that there's never been a better time to be in the wine business, or more importantly, to be on this side of the table drinking wine, because it's just, there's so many great wines produced. You know, 50 years ago, people were putting some wines in bottles that you would taste it and go, oh my God, why would they do that? You know, how can they get away with putting something like this in a bottle? And today, nobody does that, but what a great thing. We're at Jordan Vineyards and Winery. If you haven't been, make an appointment, try and get in. Wine tourism here at Jordan has evolved from the point of very few and mostly people in the trade to now that you can come here, and you should. Even if you just get to come up here and look around the property, you'll be thrilled. Rob Davis, if you'll stay with me, we'll take a quick break and come back and talk a little more. I'm Guy Bauer. It's a Good Life. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.